FM 90.3. There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 29 days into the month of June. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's spoken word department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with director Audrey-Anne Bouchard on her play Camille the Story, performing right now at the Segal Center. Plus, an episode of Talking Radical Radio. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email spokenword at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter. Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. On today's show, we have an interview with Audrey-Anne Bouchard on her play Camille the Story, being performed at the Segal Center this summer. Camille the Story is an immersive performance about the end of a friendship. Designed to engage all your senses but sight, this play offers a sensory experience that is accessible to all audience members, whether they are people who are blind, partially sighted, or sighted. That's up now. Hi, Audrey-Anne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Would you be able to introduce yourself and your work to the audience?
Absolutely. So my name is Audrey-Anne Bouchard, and I am an interdisciplinary stage artist. So I work as a theater designer, but also as a creator of new artwork that is accessible to people living with visual impairments. My work with these new creations involved that I developed a new art form that is immersive and that does not involve the audience's sight, but all their other senses. And I'm a big fan of collective creation, so I work collaboratively with all my...
So your play, Camille the Story, is currently being performed in English at the Segal Center. What is this play about?
Yes. So Camille is about the loss of a friendship. It's the story of Pierre, who is dealing with the recent departure of his friend Camille. They were friends since they were little kids. And now Pierre has to cope with her absence, but he also has to learn to create ties with new people and to trust new people in different situations. So this is what the play is about. It's a simple plot, but hopefully everyone can relate to that.
So how did you come up with the idea for this play?
Yes, I came up with the idea because I myself have a visual disability. Mm-hmm. I live with a disease called Stargardt's disease, which affects my central vision. So I only see with my peripheral vision, which means that I am partially sighted. I'm still autonomous in my work, and I'm able to, you know, to move around and to be fully autonomous, as I said, but still attending theater and dance can sometimes bring some challenges because I don't always see everything that is on stage. So it allowed me to question myself and think, well, what can a people who is blind perceive from dance and theater art forms? And how could we create and communicate those art forms beyond that visual relationship that prevails in the theater and dance forms that we, the way that we create them conventionally? So therefore, we started doing a little research with a team of collaborators. So choreographers, actors, designers, and Camille was born out of these explorations.
And what was the process of creating this play like?
Developing Camille, we've worked with different organizations like RAM, Regroupement des Aveugles et Amblyopes du Montréal Métropolitain, and CNIB, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, to invite consultants living with different kinds of visual impairments in our rehearsal to give us feedback on the process. We wanted to make sure that we made our artistic decisions based on their very specific sensibility and their way of perceiving art and the work. So they've been, the community of persons living with visual impairment in Montreal has been fully involved in the development of this piece. The process was a 3-year-long research. There was a collaborative. So basically, we were a team of 6 people. One set and costume designer, one sound designer, 2 dancers, and 1 actor with myself. And we kind of created little scenes, little tableaus, exploring how can we communicate gestures beyond the visual? How can we communicate set through their textures or the sound of the props or things like that? And we put all these little scenes together and at the end questioned ourselves, what story are we telling through all these new forms that we are slowly developing? Mm-hmm. And that's how we came to create the story of Pierre and Camille.
So in addition to having lived experience as a person living with a visual impairment, you also have a background in theater. How is it combining these two experiences in the creation of the show?
Yes, well, my background in theater served me very well, because I had a career as an established designer already when I started this research. And I had the opportunity through my work as a designer to observe a lot of other directors and different ways of creating that were inspiring to me. I did an internship in 2007 with Ex Machina, Robert Lepage's company. That's when I discovered that the collective creation aspect of the work was really appealing to me, and that's how I wanted to work for my own creations. So I would say that as a designer, I already had a good understanding of how the theatrical mechanics work and what I wanted to keep from the most conventional ways of working, and also what kind of barriers I wanted to push and what I wanted to do differently for this work. So with my team, we wore blindfolds in the rehearsals to make artistic decisions, not for their visual qualities, but for their sound qualities and for their texture qualities. So it was also a way of revisiting our own practice to create this show.
The story revolves around Pierre and the departure of his friend Camille and how he navigates her absence, revisiting memories that take shape through movement, smell, and sound. What is a memory that's featured in the show, and how is it conveyed through these senses?
All the play is happening in live voice. So basically, you will hear the characters speak beside you as you are in the stage setting, in the set, except for the memories, where the memories are audio recorded. So it's like we're entering Pierre's mind in another dimension and revisiting. There's three moments that we witness as spectators where we see what was the relationship between Pierre and Camille. So, for example, the first memory is in a cafe where Pierre used to go with Camille every morning to start the day. And even if she has been gone for 3 months now, he still goes to that cafe every morning. So he kind of sees her and has this vision of her, even if she's not there. So he's describing her to us. So we're able to understand who is this person of Camille and how important was she in his life. And with that memory comes some sounds and also some smells. And he describes a particular object, a particular piece of clothing that she used to wear all the time that becomes a very important prop in the story that we bring back at many moments. So I'm not going to give it all away, but little things like that, that later on in the show, you'll be able to feel the texture of that object that belonged to Camille.
What are some of the examples of the props used for, let's say, the coffee scene? Because you would need to focus primarily on the sounds and the smells. How does that contribute to the atmosphere?
We have a beautiful soundscape that was created for the show by Joseph Brown in collaboration with Rob Denton. And we also developed some smells that we use in a few scenes. Smells are very challenging because it's hard to find the right smells. And then when do you want them to start, you know, appearing, and how do you control when they should leave the space? So that's a whole challenge that we dealt with. And then there's also sound through vocals, through the voice of the artist. So they do sounds. Of course, there's text, there's a story, so there's speech, but they also create texture with their voices. Sometimes they would create the texture of the wind, or sometimes they would also use props, like there's a whole scene at the barber, so at the hair salon, so you could hear sounds from objects like hair dryers, razors, things like that, scissors, to really make you feel like you're there. And we also use these sounds to, in a more abstract way, to create music and to bring you out of the just the realistic experience and communicate something more poetic. And yeah, then there's a few objects that will come in contact with the audience during the show. So I think I want to keep this as a surprise because it's nice for the audience to discover what they are when they feel them in their hands.
And with that physical aspect, how did the choreography of this play develop?
Yeah, that is a very good question. We started developing it through guiding techniques for people living with visual impairments. So we took a training with our partner, the RAM, Regroupement des Aveugles et Amblyopes du Montréal Métropolitain, who taught us how we should guide someone who cannot see. And a part of the choreography is in that interaction and learning to trust your guide. So we guide the audience to their seat for the show. And we also guide them, interact with them, so give them an object. So all those are done with extreme care. And for us, these interactions are part of the choreography. Then there was a whole other research on how do we communicate gestures through their sound quality. So there's a whole scene where the character of Pierre is going into a nightclub. And we were thinking, okay, how do we make the audience feel like they are surrounded by a crowd of dancers in a nightclub? So we worked on what kind of sounds can we make with the bodies, with the steps. And once again, we wanted it to be realistic, but we also wanted to take it to a more poetic level where the sounds of the steps can tell us a story or can also become a rhythm, and that we explore in different ways. So that's how we approach the choreography.
So this play was originally performed in French. Were there any changes made in content in the translation?
No, actually, we had a very good translator, Alexis Diamond, who really worked to try and keep the rhythm and the poetry of the text in its English version. So I think that we're very close to the French version of the text, but it with the English poetry, hopefully.
Audience members who are sighted and partially sighted will be able to immerse themselves by wearing a blindfold for the entirety of the performance. How does this impact the experience of the play?
I think it changes everything for people who are sighted or partially sighted. First of all, it's a very humble exercise for them to come and give us their trust and, you know, let us take care of their belongings and wear a blindfold and let us guide them on stage to experience this whole new form of theater and dance. So what it means is that people will, at first, there will be a certain adaptation period where you'll be thinking about the fact that you can't see and it's going to be a little bit challenging. But hopefully, as soon as you'll start hearing the story and the sounds around you and you'll notice how much in a caring environment we are, you'll be able to let yourself go and just enjoy how much your other senses can also inform you on the environment and on the story. And for most people, it's quite a beautiful revelation. And it's also empowering to be able to let go and trust the performers around you. And I think it's also an interesting encounter if you get to meet spectators who are blind, mm-hmm. to understand how they can experience this type of work and what different strengths they have and compare that. So I'm looking to encourage the dialogue as well and to feed this kind of discussion after the show.
And what are some of these examples of people with visual impairments starting a dialogue about their experience with the play?
For some of them, some people have told us that it's like they enter a world where everything is accessible to them. Mm. So they're not missing any part of the action or they're not missing any information. So it's nice for them to just be in this environment where everything is adapted to the fact that they can't see. Some people have told us that they've really enjoyed all the realism that we've been able to create, but also how we've been able to take it outside their everyday life experience. Because, for example, there's a dinner scene in the show, and, you know, having dinner without sight is a daily thing for our audience members who are blind. So how do we make this dinner not just the everyday dinner, but something that's more theatrical, that's more magical? So we've kind of spent time on that. Yeah, it's a touching experience, and it's always incredible how much information people who are used to not using their eyes can process in terms of all the audio that they're able to, you know, because for people who can see, sometimes it could be a lot of information at first to have to process all together during the experience. But the beauty is that then you get used to it. You can see how all your different abilities will improve already in an hour to be able to understand an environment in a different way. But for people who are blind, yes, they can really understand and figure out all the information that they remember every little detail that we're proposing.
Unlike most productions, the audience sits in the middle of the set. Would you be able to explain the reasoning behind this choice?
So this is actually something that was important to me from the start of creating this piece, where I thought, well, if you can't see, it would be easier to understand the environment in which the characters evolve if you are part of this environment yourself. If you're sitting in the middle of the set, then it's easier for you to understand because you can maybe touch the texture of the set or the objects or hear their sound. So by bringing the audience closer, my idea was to for them to be able to access to the scenography, the set design, the costume design in a much clearer and intimate way.
What effect does the audience placement have on the experience versus if the audience was simply facing the stage?
For us, it changes everything because we play with that proximity. We only have 6 audience members per show on stage. Mm-hmm. So we're really looking to create this kind of relationship of interaction between the performers and the audience. So we have 6 performers per spectators. And sometimes for us, a specific action like handing the audience an object will be synchronized with a specific sound. So it allows us to really to make sure that all these languages work together and that we're really sharing more than just the story with the audience. If we were from afar, the audience could hear the sound and they could also listen to the actor's voice on stage, but they wouldn't be able to necessarily take an object from a performer or smell the different smells that we are investigating on stage.
Is the experience of the audience being in close proximity to the performers impact the accessibility of the experience?
I think so, absolutely. Yes, for kind of the same reasons that I mentioned before, but also because, for example, if someone would use a mobility aid or a wheelchair, we can also put their wheelchair on stage instead of having them sit in the seat that we are proposing. So we are able to adapt because there's one performer per spectator. The performer can also attend to the needs of each specific spectator. So we try and make it as accessible and as easy for everyone, yes.
How does the audience capacity of 6 impact the way that the play is experienced versus if you had it open to a larger audience?
That's a very good question. As I mentioned a little bit before, for us, we were hoping that maybe we could welcome more audience members at a time per show, but it became very clear while we were creating the piece that this synchronicity between, for example, moving the audience's chair and it happening during this specific sound or passing an object to the audience and wanting it to be synchronized with a specific smell being used on stage was more powerful to us. So we thought these were very strong artistic choices that worked well for us. So we said, well, if we have one performer per spectator, we can really all do things synchronized during the show, and this will be more impactful for the audience.
The seating in this play adds to the multisensory experience. How did the chairs differ from seating typically used in stage productions?
Mm-hmm. So these are chairs that we specifically designed for the show. So there are some surprises coming out of them. We were also able to control their movements. So it's chairs that we can rotate when we want. We can also, I don't want to say too much, but there's mm-hmm. also some vibrations coming out of the chair. So we've kind of adapted the chairs to make them even more multi-sensory, and in order for us to be able to really control them whenever we want.
The show was originally performed in 2019. Did COVID-19 impact the play, and if so, how?
Yes, COVID-19 absolutely impacted the play. So when we created the first version in 2019, it was a bit different because we didn't ask the audience to remain seated on a chair during the whole performance. We actually had the audience move around and follow the characters through the set during the story. So there were different spaces that we were welcoming the audience to walk in or sit in. And there was a very close proximity between performers and spectators. So, for example, during the dinner scene, everyone was eating, performers, spectators alike, you know, at the same table. Now with COVID, we've had to rethink the piece to make sure that we could propose a version of it that is safe, but in keeping with the immersive dimension and the multi-sensory experience. So it's been a whole other challenge to revisit it. And in, so that's why in this version, we ask audience members to remain seated, because this way audience members are distanced themselves and we also respect that distanciation. We really try and respect all COVID measures so that people could feel safe but still experience a different form of theater.
And do you feel that the safety measures as a result of the pandemic changed the impact of the show for audience members?
I mean, I think it changed the, of course it changed the impact, because it's a different one. Mm-hmm. I would say that this version is probably as impactful. In fact, we had a reviewer, Robert Saint-Amour, who came this week to this new version, and he said he even preferred it to the other version. There's less physical stimulation, but we've put in more thoughts on odors and smells, and we've developed our chairs more so that the chair would be more interesting for the spectator to sit on during the show. So I think it really depends as an audience member if you prefer the kind of experience that is engaging you physically, you know, where you get to dance, with where you get to touch the other performers. In this version, I would say maybe it's even more accessible because the spectator is a bit less involved. So therefore, people who don't necessarily like to be super active during a show, they can also just let go and enjoy the show. So for that reason, it's I think it's also as impactful and even more accessible.
So you've mentioned before some feedback that you've gotten on the play from people that have seen both the previous iteration and the current iteration. What are some other reviews that you've received about this play?
So we've received overall good reviews. I mean, I think that the first thing that comes to mind is that people mention how much of a different experience it is. So it's really an experience that we don't get to attend every day. And it really requires from you that you be open-minded to use your other senses. And if you're blind, it's an experience that will be fully adapted to your needs and the way that you perceive the world. So I think that, yeah, we've got a lot of positive feedback, and mostly just because the proposition is so unique, people are happy that they experienced it.
The show is currently being performed at the Siegel Center. If audiences wanted to see the play before the run ends, where can they buy tickets?
Yes. So they can buy tickets at the Siegel Center on their box office page online. And I also have the phone number of the box office, which is 514-739-7944. 514-739-7944. So tickets are available at the Siegel Center for Performing Arts box office. The theater is located at 5170 Côte Sainte-Catherine, Montreal. There are still a few tickets left, and I think that we might even add two extra shows since we are selling out for people to attend.
That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And are there any plans of new performances or potential tours of the show?
Well, we just finished a tour in French, but the goal is to tour this English version and even maybe to take it outside Montreal in other Canadian regions or even in the United States. So right now we are going to finish this run and then we'll put our energy on presenting it further, of course, to more audiences across Canada.
Lastly, where are audiences able to learn more about you or your projects?
So we have a website. It's the The address is www.audeladuvisuel, so audeladuvisuel.com. And on that website, you can learn all about the shows and the two different versions. So the pre-COVID version and this version, which is called Camille the Story. The website is available in French and in English, and it is fully accessible to people who live with visual impairments. And you will find all the information on myself and all the collaborators who've contributed to this work.
Thank you for this interview. You were a fantastic guest, and I really enjoyed talking to you about this play. All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a nice day.
My name is Alice Wu, and here are some of the recent headlines. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark case Roe v. Wade. This means the American federal government no longer recognizes a constitutional right to abortion. In response, hundreds of Quebecers wore black and protested in front of the Montreal courthouse on Sunday afternoon. And the Cree Nation of Chisasabi announced that it would launch the first investigation into residential school graves in Quebec. Two residential schools operated on the nation's territory from 1933 to 1981. And this summer, six emergency rooms across Quebec will be reducing their operating hours and will have to turn away ambulances. The affected regions include Lachine in Montreal. The partial closures are due to staff shortages, with 59,000 missing or absent healthcare workers across Quebec. And now for some news you can use. Seven metro stations will be free to enter on weekends until September. This is part of the city's effort to promote public transit use. The participating stations are Berry-UQAM, Charles-de-Max, McGill, Peel, Place d'Arbre, Place des Arts, and Saint-Laurent. And Montreal's International Jazz Festival is coming. It takes place in the Quartier des Spectacles and features 500 performances, both indoors and outdoors. Two-thirds of these performances are free. The festival runs for 10 days, from this Thursday, June 30th to July 9th. For more information, visit montrealjazzfest.com. And Saturday marked the return of Montreal's fireworks competition, l'Internationale du Feu Loto-Québec. World-class pyrotechnic teams will compete Wednesday and Saturday evenings over 6 weeks. They launch their fireworks from La Ronde, the Six Flags amusement park by the St. Lawrence River. For more information, visit sixflags.com/laronde-en.
Welcome back to The Avalanche. The time is now 5:33. Up now is an episode of Talking Radical Radio, titled A Grassroots Reimagining of Gender-Affirming Care. To listen to the remainder of this episode, you can access it at talkingradicalradio.ca. That's up now.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio.
That people feel pressured to perform their gender identity counter to how they actually identify in order to gain social acceptance, in order to be able to get hired, in order to be able to participate in general society, is killing people. Not even to touch on the issues that capitalism poses in the first place. We can't even have those conversations yet because we're too focused on, will we be alive tomorrow?
That's the voice of Riley Nielsen Baker. They and Felix Vandergrift are today's guests on Talking Radical Radio. This show brings you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are involved in many different struggles, talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening can strengthen all of our efforts to change the world. Nielsen Baker is a public servant who works on issues related to sexual assault and gender-based violence, and Vandergrift works as a consultant in the environmental sector. Outside of their paid work, both are active with Gender Affirming Care Nova Scotia, a grassroots community-based policy initiative focused on addressing issues of gender-affirming care and of access to healthcare in general for trans, intersex, and gender-diverse people. Gender-affirming care is any healthcare that affirms someone's gender identity through better aligning their body and physical presentation with that identity. This can include interventions like surgeries and hormone replacement therapy, as well as other forms of related care like voice training, hair removal, and supports to learn various kinds of aesthetic practices that can be important to expressing gender. According to Nielsen Baker, gender-affirming care in Nova Scotia is currently, quote, incredibly limited, incredibly gatekept, end quote. The province offers a number of basic gender-affirming surgeries through the public system. However, everything beyond that must be paid for out of pocket. Many trans people have very limited opportunities in the job market because of anti-trans discrimination, so even small financial barriers can be prohibitive. Even among the gender-affirming care that is provided publicly, access is limited by lengthy waiting lists, arbitrary gatekeeping by medical professionals, and intense bureaucracy. Access is further limited because the system pushes people to adhere to very narrow understandings of what it means to be trans, with little recognition that different people need different things to affirm their genders. And some trans people have no interest in fitting themselves into dominant understandings of male and female, or into medicalized stereotypes of transness. Gender-affirming care has repeatedly been demonstrated to be crucial for keeping trans people alive. Nielsen Baker says they have a slogan that they use a great deal within their group, though much more cautiously in public contexts. Quote, trans suicides are a policy choice, end quote. It's well known what needs to be done to reduce trans suicides, and the choice not to do those things is a form of blatant, active disregard for trans people's survival. In late 2020, Nielsen Baker was part of a small leftist organizing group in Nova Scotia and was working on a number of policy proposals for the group aimed as interventions in the then-upcoming provincial election, including one related to gender-affirming care. They were uneasy, however, about the possibility of feeding into the politicization, in a party political sense, of the needs and lives of trans people. Perhaps with an eye to the disturbing trajectories in the US and the UK, Nielsen Baker said, quote, when we politicize trans lives, trans people lose, end quote. So early in 2021, Nielsen Baker decided instead to pursue the work as an independent, grassroots, community-based process. Starting with a handful of participants and some informal consultation, the process grew to include a lively core group, which today includes Vandergrift, extensive consultations with other trans people in the province, and endorsements from more than 50 organizations, including LGBTQ2S+ groups, unions, churches, and professional organizations. The work has involved documenting how things work now in Nova Scotia, how other jurisdictions do things, and what the community wants. And it has resulted in a robust and detailed policy that, if adopted, would dramatically improve gender-affirming care in Nova Scotia. The overarching thrust of the policy is to remove barriers to gender-affirming care and to expand coverage within the public system. Rather than engaging with politicians about gender-affirming care, the group is focused on building support in the general public through a series of town halls and other forms of public engagement, and on working directly with the provincial public service to get these changes integrated into the provincial healthcare system. I speak with Nielsen Baker and Vandergrift about gender-affirming care in general, and about the work of Gender-Affirming Care Nova Scotia.
My name is Felix Vandergrift. My pronouns are he, him, or they, them. I've been working a lot in environmental consultation, sustainability. When I came out in 2019, it sort of became really evident that gender-affirming care is a big issue in our province. So instead of just continuing to go with it and accept it as is, I decided to get involved and get active with gender-affirming care.
My name is Riley Nielsen Baker. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. And I'm the author and organizer of Gender-Affirming Care Nova Scotia. I'm currently a public servant working in the field of gender-based and sexual assault policy and programming, working on issues of access to justice. I am also a current Master's of Political Science student at Dalhousie University studying Canadian politics with my thesis work focused on the concept of the transgender person in Canadian case law. I have my Master's of Public Administration from Dalhousie University. Gender-affirming care in Nova Scotia is a grassroots community-based policy to address issues not just of gender-affirming care, but issues of access to healthcare and healthcare competency for the healthcare of members of the trans, intersex, and gender-diverse community here in Nova Scotia. We're really focused on removing barriers and adding protections for those who either require gender-affirming care in this province or are just a member of our community and need help accessing healthcare. We want to make sure that everyone can have access to equitable, responsive healthcare in this province. In my policy training and policy education, the importance of consultation is always so emphasized because you can't make policy about or for people without including them, because they are the ones that are the most impacted by what's happening in these systems. They know where it's failing. They know how to fix a lot of these issues. And really, community-based policy work is just taking that a step further. Not only is a community consulting on the policy, the community is making the policy. We are having 100% control and 100% say in what's happening in this policy and what potentially will happen in the healthcare system here in Nova Scotia.
There's this infantilization of a lot of Indigenous communities, Black communities, queer communities that all share this sort of same idea that you don't know what's best for you. So we, the government, are going to make the rules for you. And that is almost the exact experience I had when I came out and started doing this transition was, oh, you don't know what's best for you. And, you know, I'm a well-educated person and have lots of experience working in consulting. Like, why can't I decide what's best for me and my health and my body? And there's so many young people out there that are being disenfranchised and marginalized even further, especially if you're not white.
What, in general terms, is gender-affirming care?
Gender-affirming care is any access to health care that affirms your gender identity. A lot of people think that it has to do with just surgeries or just hormone replacement therapy, which is absolutely part of it. But essentially, it's any healthcare that an individual can access that better aligns their identity, their physical characteristics, their emotional state or well-being to better align with how they identify with their gender identity.
People, when you hear the word healthcare, automatically assume, like you said, surgeries and hormones and the like. But there's also programs in other provinces that include things like haircuts and voice training and like sessions for makeup tutorials or how to dress to better suit what gender you are trying to identify as or express. There's lots of publicly funded programs in other parts of the world that help with those aspects of things too. And to me, that's also a part of it that's really important for not only yourself, but existing in the public.
And how does gender-affirming care work in Nova Scotia at the moment?
Currently in Nova Scotia, our gender-affirming care is incredibly limited, incredibly gatekept. Kind of like how Felix just mentioned, gender-affirming care is not just surgeries, it's not just hormones. Here in the province of Nova Scotia, that is all it is. And even then, what we're getting is incredibly limited, not just in what is offered, but who is actually able to offer it. Currently under our process here in Nova Scotia, hormones, they usually do have to pay for out of pocket. The only options that people have that are publicly funded are issues such as the stereotypical surgeries that people associate with transgender, intersex, and non-binary individuals. Even though those things are covered, that is a very incredibly limited list that only covers the bare minimum, if even that. It doesn't cover issues like Felix mentioned, like voice training, hair removal, Adam's apple shaving. It really doesn't cover anything, realistically. And even in that, surgeries and procedures such as breast augmentation are further limited. If you're a trans feminine individual who would like to access top surgery for breast augmentation, frequently, if you have the breast development equivalent of a 14-year-old girl, so a child, you actually don't qualify for publicly funded breast augmentation. If you do want it, you'll have to pay out of pocket. And that's really what we're talking about here at first. We're talking about making a system that actually covers the transitionary needs from a healthcare perspective. That's only maybe at most 50% of these processes when it comes to trans healthcare. On top of that, if you are a member of our community in this province, you are unable to probably find a healthcare practitioner who actually has, you know, ever encountered a transgender, intersex, or gender diverse individual, let alone knows how to practice healthcare on a member of our community. And that's a huge problem. Here in this province, we have maybe 10 people who practice healthcare specific to the trans community, and the majority of them are located within Halifax Regional Municipality. People are having to wait on average 4 to 5 years for top surgery. And I have met people who have waited 11 years for top surgery, which is absolutely ridiculous and unacceptable. On top of that, many procedures are further limited into you can only access this procedure if you access a different procedure, regardless of whether or not you need it, which has people accessing transitionary care for their bodies that they don't need.
It's forcing trans folks and non-binary, particularly or gender non-conforming folks, into these awful boxes of binary care that many trans folks don't identify with. If I don't identify as masculine enough, I won't receive the care that I need. Or if I don't say, yes, I'm transitioning female to male, I won't receive the care that I need. When in actual fact, I consider myself more of a gender diverse person who kind of fluctuates in between those things, but explaining that to a healthcare provider raises eyebrows, and then I might not get the care that I need. On top of that, we talk about a lot of these really awful limiting factors and gatekeeping. One of the reasons that I actually became active in this sphere myself is because I'm a power lifter. That is one of the things that gives me lots of gender euphoria. And in that, I am what most people would consider the obese category. And so they wouldn't even book my consultation for a top surgery because my BMI was too high. So there's all kinds of these little nuanced things. But then there's also these really glaring issues like, no, you can't access that unless you're truly transitioning to female, or you can't access breast augmentation if you don't have breast development of a 12-year-old, or you're non-binary, AFAB.
And that stands for assigned female at birth.
You don't count for top surgery or chest masculinization surgery because you fall in this weird in-between we don't understand.
What Felix is touching on is something that's colloquially known in our community as the trans test. And I have never met a single person who feels that they have not either directly gone through the trans test or indirectly gone through the trans test. And that refers to the idea that we have to prove ourselves to our assessors that we are trans enough in their eyes. And that means fitting into boxes of high mask and high feminine categories. The idea that you have to be the perfect trans in order to access these care. A huge problem here is that on top of all of that, practically all of the people who are doing these assessments aren't even a member of our community. Most of them aren't even in the larger queer umbrella, which places huge barriers to prove to people who have no conceptualization about our experience that we are in fact, quote, trans enough to access care. And the idea that there is one idea or even two ideas of acceptable transness is ridiculously limiting to all of us.
Like, it's just so ridiculous. Like, it's so many steps. It's so many hoops. Like, I work in bureaucracy for a living. From the get-go, even from the name change process, this has been an absolutely bureaucratic nightmare of paperwork, of specialists, of checklists, not to mention the cost. So like when we had this sort of minute of crisis where the only surgeon in the province who was doing surgeries said he's retiring, my gut sank because I knew we were going to lose people from suicide, from addiction, from violence, from whatever, because that's their last hope. Because this process is so burdensome and so onerous, and the policy is so outdated, you already have people that are strapped to mental capacity. That's just so heartbreaking, but it's also so preventable.
We have had this slogan that we've used at Gender Affirming Care since the start that we don't really talk about publicly because it makes people very uncomfortable, that trans suicides are a policy choice. This is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a lack of political will, and doing nothing is absolutely a choice. And it is a choice that has to be actively made. By making this policy choice and the policy choices that we have made historically, we are saying that trans suicides are acceptable, that they're not worth it to us to do anything about. I also want to touch on a little bit as well that to access gender-affirming care in this province, especially procedures such as surgery, you are required to get at least two recommendations, one from a psychiatrist and one from a psychologist. The idea of this process is a holdover from a history of trans medicalization and pathologization. The idea that trans people are mentally ill, that we are sick, that we need to be protected from ourselves. No, we don't. in that fact that we still require a psychological assessment to determine our readiness to access gender-affirming care that is completely necessary for us is unacceptable. There's also the issue of the financial costs of these for trans people. Trans people are more likely to live below the poverty line. They are less likely to have upward economic mobility. They are more likely to be unemployed, homeless, and in debt. They are less likely to have economic opportunities, educational opportunities. And this debt comes from trying to privately fund these surgeries and procedures themselves. The reason that we are less likely to have these economic and social opportunities is because of transphobia. We need to work to address that. The fact that people feel pressured to perform their gender identity counter to how they actually identify in order to gain social acceptance, in order to be able to get hired, in order to be able to participate in general society, is killing people and it's hurting people, forcing people into these dangerous economic situations, not even to touch on the issues that capitalism poses in the first place, because what we're talking about is existence in the current system. We can't even have those conversations yet because we're too focused on, will we be alive tomorrow?
How did gender-affirming care Nova Scotia, meaning the grassroots community-based policy process that you're a part of, get started?
Around the end of 2020, I was a part of a very small political left-leaning organization, and I was their parliamentarian and policy person, and I was working on a couple of policy proposals to deal with the housing crisis, as well as gender-affirming care. They were basically a handful of policy ideas that the organization was planning to take towards the next provincial election, which was the one that occurred in 2021, trying to get them on parties' platforms so that they become political issues, that we can make them electoral issues, and we could see some change. And after a few months, around February 2021, I looked at the work I'd done and realized this is more than a policy proposal. It is actually some incredibly good policy work. And I made the decision to take it out of this political organizing group as to not further politicize trans lives, because when we politicize trans lives, trans people lose, and to try to make something more grassroots, an independent community-based grassroots policy movement. And it just kind of grew from there. We started by collecting some local supporters, consulting with a handful of trans people that I either knew and really extended out that through web networking and outreach. By the time we got to a year later, we had the endorsement of about 50 organizations, including huge organizations like Doctors Nova Scotia, like EGAL, like Nova Scotia Rainbow Action Project, like Wisdom to Action. Today, we are doing media interviews like this one. We're actively consulting with government, with the Department of Health and Wellness. We're working with our partner organizations to put on events such as our town halls, to talk to people both in our community and just in the general public about what issues we're facing as a trans community and what can actively be done. So it started the same way that any policy does, with an idea. I knew that our system of gender-affirming care was broken. As a trans non-binary person, I see where these problems are. I'm going to start investigating, looking through health policy documents that the province currently operates, looking and talking to members of the community that weren't officially consultations at the time, but just having conversations of where people have seen system fail. And then it was announced in March 2021 that the Yukon was going to completely overhaul their gender-affirming care system. So after that, we basically took that work that they did in the Yukon and said, let's see how we can take this a step further. It was a lot of reading and research, jurisdictional scans to kind of see where we are now and where realistically the community thinks we should go. Really centering the trans, gender diverse, and intersex experience in everything we did. And since then, we've read however many academic works and medical works, consulted with members of the healthcare community, consulted with hundreds of members of the trans community, both in Nova Scotia and in Canada at large. And it came about the same way that really any policy in government would, except that this is completely community-led and community-focused.
What are some of the key elements of the policy that you're bringing forward?
We're talking about, one, removing barriers, and two, expanding coverage. For removing barriers, we're talking about removing those letters from psychiatrists and psychologists. It also talks about making gender-affirming care, treating it all as medically necessary. We treat it as medically necessary and not as boutique care, not as cosmetic care. Then we actually focus on what is happening in the trans experience, in the trans community, and making sure that people get the care that they need in a timely manner and focusing on the fact that it is life-saving care. Making sure that we're focusing instead on making sure that someone is quote-unquote trans enough to access care. We're instead focusing on what they need and making educated decisions about their life and their choices. It focuses on making the person the primary assessor. And this goes to address, one, making sure that people aren't getting medically unnecessary procedures just to check a box for the system. But also, if we center the individual as the decision maker for their care, we can help address some issues of medical racism where we know that people of color, especially Black people, especially Indigenous people, are less likely to get approved for medically necessary care than their white counterparts. By instead of focusing on the opinions of their healthcare provider, who is very much potentially exposed to severe medical bias, we instead focus on the individual's care needs, and they are making their decisions, and the medical bias is less likely to play a role. We also focus on the importance of euphoria. Now, everyone knows about the trans experience and dysphoria, the suffering that we experience because how we exist socially and how we are viewed socially, either because of our bodies or because of other issues of socialization that occur in the trans person's experience. We all know about that. But dysphoria is not the only determinant of the necessity of gender-affirming care. It's not even necessarily the strongest determinant. What is euphoria, which is the satisfaction, the happiness, the security that one gets from having their social experience, their physical experience validated and reflected in their daily life and in the healthcare that they receive. So by centering euphoria, one, we stop talking about trans suffering and we start emphasizing trans happiness. We start using medical determinants that are actually reflective of what's going on and properly providing care and allocating care where it's actually needed. We vastly expand what is actually covered under this policy. We remove barriers such as BMI and a Tanner scale that limits people's ability to access gender-affirming care unnecessarily. We cover issues such as body contouring.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news I brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to an interview with Adrienne Bouchard on her play Camille the Story, followed by an episode of Talking Radical Radio. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, you can check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at @avalancheckut or CKUT Spoken Word Department at spokenword@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hersey, that's up next. Thank you.
Jessica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guest in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It's just after 6 p.m. and this is In the Motherhood for June 15th, 2022. I'm your host today, Robin Fadden. On today's show, we'll be borrowing two pieces of content from Wings, a Canadian radio show, whom we thank always for letting us air their content here in Montreal on CKUT. The first part of the show features Lema Gabawi on peacemaking and talking about women who must make places for themselves or spaces for themselves in all negotiations. So I invite you to listen to that now. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
Someone can slap you and you slap them back and think that after slapping that person is going to bring peace. No. It's just going